You're listening to the Silicon Valley Podcast.
On this week's episode of the Silicon Valley Podcast, we sit down with Martin Tobias, who has over the years raised over $500 million in equity, project finance, and working capitals for companies where he was the CEO. He has also personally invested in over 70 startups and led about half a dozen through venture funds. On today's show, we talk about how has pre-seed and seed stages changed over the years? Are there any emergent solutions or trends to facilitate better connections between founders and the right investors? How are founders leveraging AI to better prepare for investor meetings? And what benefits does it bring to the pitching process? In the current global landscape, is this the best or worst time to start a company? And much, much more. All right, I know everyone's going to enjoy this week's episode, so let's begin.
Welcome to the Silicon Valley Podcast with your host, Sean Flynn, who interviews famous entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and leaders in tech. Learn their secrets and see tomorrow's world today.
Martin, I'm super excited for this week's episode of the Silicon Valley Podcast. Before we dive into the questions, can you give our audience a little bit of background, a little bit of your history, your career up until this point?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Sean. Good to talk to you again. So I've been an entrepreneur a bunch of times. I started out in business. In college, I couldn't decide whether I liked business or computer science more. So I double majored in both. And what I always liked doing was solving business problems with computers. A lot of my friends in computer science were doing the really purely technical things like writing device drivers and hardware drivers and things like that. And I was writing like Excel spreadsheets that traded stocks, right? So I've always been interested in the business applications of technology. And that led me to Anderson Consulting and then to Microsoft. And after I left Microsoft, I started my first company. I was a 3x venture funded CEO, took two companies public. And I've also, since Microsoft, always invested in companies as an angel. I invested prior to this fund in about 250 companies. I'm an LP in 17 funds, and I've always liked how technology can really improve people's lives and the power of supporting entrepreneurs very early. The first fund I ever invested in was Ron Conway's Silicon Valley Angels Fund, and he found these two guys named Larry and Sergey when they were at Google and gave them some money and gave the limited partners, including me, shares in the IPO of Google, some of which I still own. And my cost basis is like 50 cents on Google. And that's been a lifetime lesson for the power of helping entrepreneurs very early. And this is what I'm trying to do as an investor now, an early pre-seed investor, investing in B2B software companies today.
With all those investments, the number of funds you're part of, the number of seeds, how have you been able to keep track of these investments over the years? Do you have a spreadsheet system or?
I have a spreadsheet for that. And it's interesting. A lot of people are starting to write software for VCs now and for investors to help you track your private portfolios a little bit better. And I'm excited for some of those companies, but it's a spreadsheet. And the reality is the majority of those investments are fairly passive investments. If you write a $25,000 angel investment into a company, you're not on the board, you're not doing a bunch of stuff. So you're helping the CEO whenever you can, but it's different from being a lead investor where you're on the board and have a lot of things. I've been on a couple of boards, but I'm on a lot fewer boards than I have made investments.
Now, a lot of people, they, at least from conversations I've had, they really want to be on boards. Is that something that you've done and it's not of interest anymore? Or
in venture capital, you have this thing or this term a lot of people to say, which is your strategy is your fund size. And my fund size in this one is $10 million. If you're a small fund, you're basically not leading rounds. I'm investing in pre-seed rounds that are $500,000 or $1.5 million. My average check is $250,000. So I'm not the lead in those rounds. And generally in pre-seed, there's not a traditional lead. It's usually PitchBook said for the average $1 million pre-seed round, the average check is $25,000. So there's a lot of angels in there and there's a few funds like mine, but there's not a traditional lead guy taking 90% of the round that gets a board seat for that. Usually the board seats start to happen in the seed or the A. And as I'm a pre-seed investor, you usually don't get board seats with those rounds. So I have been on boards. I've been on public boards. I don't mind boards. But the reality is also that in the traditional fund, a partner can do maybe 8 or 9 board seats. I'm going to have 30 investments in this fund. It's not possible to be on 30 boards. I'm very active with the CEOs who want me to be, but my strategy is to have more investments rather than a concentrated investment and to not be a 20% ownership fund. If you're a large fund, if you're a $1 billion fund, you're buying 20% of the company, you're sitting on boards, you have all the infrastructure. This is a large fund strategy. This is not a small fund strategy.
And Martin, how come you've focused on that low funds, the pre-seed, your whole career? Isn't it the journey of start a smaller fund, then get bigger? The next fund is, you know, so much bigger than the fund before. And then the next fund is so much bigger. And by fund 3, fund 4, it's a $200 million fund. Sure. Why always stay on the pre-seed side?
That's been the journey for a lot of young managers, is that they want to create a new fund and a brand, and they want to get more AUM. And the game in VC has always been to get more AUM so you get more fees so you can pay yourself giant salaries. But if you look at the different returns in different stages of venture capital, basically in pre-seed, you have the opportunity for the highest potential multiple on your money. And that means you're investing earliest. And the reality is that the later you invest, the lower your average return. And one of the things that I did when I was thinking about going full-time to investing was to look at my returns across my venture capital portfolio as an LP versus my direct investments as an early angel in the pre-seed. And in the 17 funds, or I think at that time I was in 12 funds, I was getting about 2.8x TVPI on my LP interest, which is about average for a venture capital firm over 10 years. But I was getting about 6.2x on my direct angel investments. So I was doing 3 times better because I was investing earlier than the average venture capital. And I'm in some pretty big funds. I'm in RRE ventures and industry ventures. If you're a multi-stage fund, you have larger checks to deploy. The law of numbers just tell you that your average returns are going to be less. You might make more total money. I actually have an interesting story about exactly that. I was at a poker game in London with a bunch of PE guys and some VCs and some founders. And I don't know if you play poker, there's an initial buy-in, and if you lose your money, you can buy in again. So I bought in for the initial buy-in. I think it was $500. And at the end of the night, I had made only one buy-in and I was up about 2.5x my money, or no, I was up 3.5x my money. There was a PE guy there who led Series C rounds. He bought in 3 times. So he bought in for $1,500. He made more total money than me, but he was only up 2x his money, right? So he put more money into the game. He got more money out of the game, but his multiple on the money was lower than my multiple on the money, which is the same in venture capital. If you look at PitchBook's data or Crunchbase data or Cambridge's data, basically sub $50 million funds tend to outperform on a multiple basis because they're investing earlier. Cambridge has a report. For the last 10 years, they rank the top 10 venture capital firms in terms of returns, IRR. Usually 60, 70% of the funds are sub $100 million, sub $50 million fund ones. And the reason is because they're investing earlier than the large funds.
Now, has that changed over time at all? Was 10 years ago pre-seed investment similar to a year ago? What about over the last 12 months? Has that sector, that realm changed at all?
Venture capital has changed radically since I've been in. I'm one of the, I just heard this term a couple of weeks ago, a 3-cycle investor. I have invested in the downturn of 2020, in the downturn of 2008, the great financial crisis, as well as the crash of 2020. Back then, venture capital has changed radically. The amount of money in venture capital, the number of multi-stage firms. I don't believe in 2000 or in the late 90s when I started, there were any $1 billion firms. The average venture fund was a $200 million fund. In 2003, when I was at Ignition, which I think at the time was a $150 million fund, we led the Series A of DocuSign, And that was a $4 million Series A. The Series A used to be the first venture round, or the first round that any company raised. And now you've got an angel round, a pre-seed, a seed before the A, which is more like a $40 million round. So the number of rounds has expanded, and there is pre-seed is a relatively new thing in the last 10 years that there are institutional investors that focus just on those first institutional rounds. The Series A today is really something which is done only by multi-stage $1 billion or a couple hundred million dollar or more funds. And then Series Bs are done by these $4 or $5 billion multi-stage funds. There are extremely different parts to the venture capital community. It's also incredibly difficult for those large funds to do the pre-seed. And I work with a lot of them. I have regular monthly calls with Tiger and Madrona and all these big funds. I did a deal last year with Madrona. The CEO pitched Madrona, which is currently investing out of an $800 million fund. And the CEO wanted to raise a $750,000 pre-seed. And the reality is Madrona can't get out of bed for $750,000 in $800 million fund. They have to deploy a $4 or $5 million check into every company. It's just too small of a round for a fund that size. So I knew the partner. They introduced him to me. I met the guy. I liked him. I put in some money. They put in a little bit of a starter check money, and we got a few other investors. We did the round. And then a year later, Madrona had been tracking the company, and they gave the company a term sheet for a $7 million seed round. Because that's the round they really wanted to do, is to deploy enough capital to be meaningful in their fund. That's why there is today in venture capital this niche called pre-seed investor, who are the investors that put together these $1-1.5 million rounds. That typically is too small of a check. If you have a $300 million fund, you simply can't write that check.
Are you seeing a lot of collaboration then, more now than say 5-10 years ago, between these VCs and angels and angel groups? And
I'm not seeing as much collaboration between the large funds and these angel groups and so on, but I'm seeing, and one of the reasons I like pre-seed is it tends to be a very collaborative time to invest. I know probably 100 managers of funds my size, sub $50 million funds, and we all share deals together and we all talk about things we're doing. And it's very collaborative during pre-seed because you need 3, 4, or 5 funds plus some angels to get a round done. What happens in the A is the elbows start to come out and get sharp. And one fund wants to own 20-25% of the company. So then they're competing with everybody else. And Andreessen Horowitz is talking shit about NEA and Index and all of these guys. And they're fighting because there can only be one. There can only be one lead, right? And when you have to deploy big checks, you've got to win competitive rounds. And there's enough information to compete. It's a very different game at pre-seed. And it's much more kind of the old way that early venture rounds used to be done, which is very collaborative, where everybody's really working together to try to help this entrepreneur get to the next level. But when a company is breaking out at the A, it gets very competitive. I have a company right now that's raising a B. They have top 5% metrics. They had 3 competing term sheets. And I was just on a call before. A reason I was a little bit late starting is that the CEO has to make a decision on competing term sheets today. And the VCs are putting a lot of pressure because obviously they want to win.
Going back to the communication between the founders and the investors, why is it that, it seems, the probability of the investors and the founders meeting is so low, or the correct ones? Yep. Why is that? Has that changed over time? Is that getting better?
I hope it's getting better. I certainly think it's getting better for me. But the reality is that investors and founders are in a low probability matching game. I say no 99% of the time. Founders hear no 99% of the time. That's why you hear so much frustration from founders around the VC thing. And my approach to that solution, and it's different from some other VCs, is to communicate more about my sweet spot. Because what a lot of VC websites, you go to them, they say, we fund great founders. And every founder says, I'm a great founder. This does not help the low probability matching game. Because the reality is the VC has a sweet spot. has some particular interests, verticals that they're looking for, stages, multiple founders, immigrant founder, women, whatever. They have things that they tend to not communicate very well because what they're trying to do is keep their top of the funnel as broad as possible. But keeping a high, a broad top of the funnel doesn't help the founder find the right investor. And so what I do on Twitter, and I have a whole bunch of followers on Twitter, is I try to say, if you're going to pitch me, here's some verticals I'm looking for. Here's some products I wish were out in the world. Is anybody building this kind of thing? Here's the stage that I like to invest in. I define pre-seed as you have an MVP done. So if you haven't finished your MVP, you're in the angel round and you should probably raise from friends and family instead of pitching me. I'm trying to communicate my sweet spot so that founders in my sweet spot can find me and founders will know when is the right time to pitch me. Because most of the time, I receive about 300 pitches a month and probably 60 or 70% of them fall out before I ever make any recommend opinion on the founder or the market or anything. It just has to do with timing and stage. If they haven't built their MVP yet, or maybe they're raising a Series A and I don't invest in Series A, maybe they've gotten too much traction. But I think communication from both founders and investors is what helps them find each other. Because when you find that magical match, it's really great. But what's going to solve that is more communication on both sides.
For that communication, would you recommend either like in a newsletter or these are the stages our company's at, or an email that says specific, we were at your website, we know you like this in a company and we match this for these reasons. Like,
well, absolutely.
I mean, education.
Absolutely. Not every VC does this, but for example, I posted a post on my website, my blog on incisive.vc, where I said the 7 meta themes that I'm looking for. And some of the best founders have read my website, have read my blog post and said, oh, you invest in these 7 themes. We fit 6 of them. And here's why. And I also post my portfolio. I post my definition of stages. I have another post, which is very popular on my website called My Definition of Stages, how I define angel and pre-seed and seed and Series A, what the different traction metrics are, what the different things that are I'm looking for, the round sizes. And I've had lots of founders email me and say, I read that post. We're a little bit early, but we do fit your meta themes. Would you mind having a meeting? And sometimes I'll say yes, because they've done the work to, because they believe that in 3 months, they'll be the perfect fit for me. And maybe they want to have a meeting early. I recommend founders do a lot of research. And what's missing on many VC websites is the things like, what is your theme? What is your definition of stage? What is specifically your sweet spot? In fact, I think about writing a blog post that says, my sweet spot is. It doesn't mean that's the only thing I invest in, but 80% of the companies fit this kind of thing and just put it right out there. I understand a lot of VCs may not want to do that because they think they might constrain their funnel and miss other opportunities. But personally, I do that because I do in fact have a very specific model that I'm looking for. Not every VC does. Some VCs are just generalist and they want to invest in any good deal. And you should pitch those guys if that's what they are, but that's not me.
Yeah, it's funny. I was having a call the other week with a family office and the guy there was complaining to me about not having good deal flow. And I was like, your website's a mountain with cloud and there's no information there at all what you want. He's, we don't want people to know about us. I was like,
okay, right, well, how are people who you are interested in going to find you? If you don't tell them what you're looking for. Yeah, exactly.
Well, what are your thoughts of, there's all these databases out there of investors. There's PitchBook, there's yep. Crunchbase. What are your thoughts of those resources?
I think they're good for founders. What I'm excited about is the upgrade to those kind of databases that are starting to understand things like stage and check and thesis area and things like that. But there's another one called signal.nfx.com. My email is in all of those things. And there are people starting to write software tools for founders that let you spam all of the investors in those databases. Personally, I don't think that's a very good fundraising strategy for founders because, like I say on my website and right on my Twitter handle, I don't do crypto. But these crypto CEOs will get those databases and spam everybody in there saying, I'm building this crypto thing. And I'm like, you did absolutely no research on me at all. You're just spamming me. So in that way, they're not helpful. What I'm excited about is some of the new databases that are coming out that are allowing founders to find those things like your stage, like your thesis, like your sectors, so that you can constrain your outreach to more highly likely investors. That process is starting to happen. And I'm excited about that because the databases are important, but databases that turn into spam engines end up hurting the process.
What about other forms of technology to help prepare entrepreneurs? There's, in our last conversation, you mentioned Mean VC.
Yeah.
Not sure if you want to share that with the audience, but how can AI leverage entrepreneurs and investors to have that conversation?
So one of the greatest things that founders can do is pitch a lot of investors, get a lot of questions, understand what they're doing. So part of the problem with that is like, how do you get the pitch meeting in the first place? So Yohi over at Untapped Ventures wrote this chatbot called Mean VC, which is basically going to ask a founder all of the rude questions that a VC might do and do it with a chatbot. And it's actually pretty good at asking founders questions that a normal VC might ask. And I recommend every founder go and use that. There are also tools like, forget, pitchdeck.ai or something, I forget the name of it, but that will analyze your pitch deck with AI and score it and help you improve it on that. There are other people building tools. And I recommend that founders do all, like one of my favorite search engines is perplexity.ai. And Perplexity seems to be doing a very good job, especially with startups and VCs, to surface up information. And for example, I use it for competitive research. And I'm surprised how many founders don't use that. You'll see a lot of founder slides and the competitive slides are weak because they only know two or three companies. You go to Perplexity, you'll find 20 companies that are building in your same area. I use it for diligence, but these tools are helping you see what you don't see. And it's good for founders to understand, like they've got this idea of building this thing and they don't know that there's 20 other people building the same thing in other cities, but Perplexity does. They also don't know what kind of questions VCs will ask you, but Mean VC does. And I think these tools are really going to help this matching process because it's going to improve people's pitches. It's going to improve their knowledge about the overall startup ecosystem, who's building what. And I think it's going to be help solve this low probability matching thing, right? If your pitch is better.
So right there, you'd mentioned using perplexity.ai to do some market research for the competitors. With all your investments, everything, how much time do you have to do due diligence on companies? And when you do diligence, what does that kind of look like?
Sure. I might be old school in the way that I, in fact, do due diligence. There was a time up to about a year ago or a year and a half ago where a lot of VCs did no due diligence. And companies were able to raise money all the time. And they would do things like, say, the round's closing on Friday. Do you want in or not? And luckily for the entire ecosystem, we are not in that buy before midnight tonight scenario anymore. I don't think it was good for anybody. It wasn't good for companies. It wasn't good for VCs. You certainly saw that. You saw things like, look at the VCs that invested in X without ever seeing financial statement or calling. I mean, it was terrible. So I get about 300 pitches a month. I have a screening process that screens out probably 270 of them or 250 of them. I look at about 50 decks. I get meetings with about 10 companies. And out of those 10 companies, I start diligence on two or three. And my diligence process, I have a list of questions. I send the CEO a Notion page that they fill out. And it's some pretty basic information, articles of incorporation, financial statements, questions about what you would do with different money, your tool stack, stuff like that. And then based on those questions and references in your LinkedIn, I start a diligence process, which includes normal financial diligence, but also I use tools like Bridge to find out who I know, who knows the CEO, and I do reference checks. And I don't just do the reference checks that the CEO gives me. I find somebody who knows the CEO who he doesn't know that I know, and I call them. And for example, if the CEO says fund X is interested in investing, I'll call the partner at that fund and I'll say, what are you thinking about? How are you thinking about this company? So I do a lot of personal reference check. If it's a bigger investment, I'll call customers and do customer reference checks. The most important thing for me, though, at pre-seed is the founding team. And so I spend a lot of time looking at what they've done. I'm Googling them. I'm using Perplexity to find their background. It is astounding to me that I was in Silicon Valley last week and I met a VC friend of mine who just had a company blow up due to CEO fraud. The CEO stole the money. And this partner did not do the diligence on that company his venture associate did. And after this company blew up for fraud, the partner is, I wonder if he really did the diligence. And he Googled the CEO. In the first five result when he Googled the CEO was a conviction of the CEO for securities fraud in a prior company. And he was pissed because this guy could not have done the diligence, because on the list of things to do is to Google the CEO and the word lawsuit. Like, you would be surprised how many VCs don't do that. And this VC was a pretty big VC and their team skipped that step. And that step would have saved them this particular investment going bad. It is astounding.
Something like that, I'm really curious, how would the VC then go back to the LPs? Because wouldn't the LPs know about this and just be a little bit infuriated?
Oh, absolutely. This particular VC fired that team member and basically had to tell his LPs. This was not a pleasant conversation for that VC to have with his LPs. But it was like anything else. You have a company, you have an employee that's not performing. What do you do? Yeah, an employee makes a major mistake. VCs make mistakes too. This VC's team member made a mistake. And so far, his LPs have been understanding. VCs are not perfect people. They make mistakes.
Now, have you seen kind of the VC landscape or your career three cycles?
Yeah.
How have things changed over those three cycles, the ups and downs? What from the past experiences are you taking right now for what may lay ahead in 2024, 2025?
The first thing is there's obviously a ton more money available in venture. Plus, there's a ton more opportunity. All markets, no matter what you're doing, are way bigger. But the other thing to realize is, what are the meta trends that are underlying the core area that you're investing in? I did a post on Twitter the other day, and it was about hardware efficiencies and deflation. I bought the new iPhone 15, right? It has 1 terabyte of storage. It has a studio quality video camera, has an app platform and internet connectivity, all for less than $2,000. I look back in 2007, I was building a big server farm. I was paying $100,000 for a terabyte of disk storage in 2007 and $50,000 for a studio quality video camera. I now have those $150,000 things plus more apps and internet connectivity in a sub $2,000 device. If you're investing in 2007, companies that were riding that deflation, right? This is a trend going forward that you were betting on. And what you need to understand as a venture capital investor is that there's different times that have different trends that you're betting on that are going to make your investments worth more. There was a time where people were connecting to the internet via ISDN line. And then there became other ways. So the expansion of broadband caused lots of opportunity. Then came the cloud, right? When I set up my first company, we had to rent space at Exodus, buy our own servers, manage all of it. Now you can rent as you need on the cloud. That thing turned out to be a step function in terms of expanding opportunity for all kinds of startups. And you need to understand what the things that are going to expand the market are coming and where you are in the stage of those things. For example, a lot of people thought AI has gone crazy in the last year with ChatGPT, but people have been talking about AI for 30 years, right? And the question was always, when is it going to become a tool that every company can incorporate to make their applications better, to expand the market, to be able to build applications that nobody could build before? That was never possible until a year ago with ChatGPT. So if you were an AI investor 30 years ago, you probably lost all your money because no AI application ever got opened up to the mass market. But so you need to understand if you believe that AI is going to change the world, is the industry in the expansion and general availability of that? What's one of the things I'm excited? I've been investing for 25 years. I think right now, in the next 2 years, are going to be the best time to be an early stage investor in my lifetime, because there's two or three things that are coming together. One is you have just had a pretty significant downturn in the public markets and big tech is laying people off. There was a study that came out a couple of weeks ago. They interviewed 1,500 people that were laid off by big tech. A full 68% of them said they will start new companies. And if you look historically in the different cycles, in 2001 and 2, company formations exploded because people got fired from other companies, right? 2009, same thing happened. Here we are again. This is something you understand if you saw the cycles before. Then you've got the primitives that people build companies on, with the cloud, and now with AI, are better than ever before. So companies can build more with less money than ever before. It's faster to build whatever you want to build. People talk about AI putting people out of work. As a pre-seed investor, when you're investing in startups, the gating factor, is especially software startups, is always development velocity. Every startup I've ever invested in has more than they want to build and less people to build it. Like, they just simply have more that they want to build and not enough time. But now with co-pilots and AI, you can turn a normal developer into a 10x developer. You can build more with less money. So what are we going to get? We're going to get more startups. And they're going to build faster and their products are going to be cheaper. It is an amazing golden era for people that want to start companies. And I think that's the same thing for investors. The other thing that's happened is that valuations have corrected. I really was struggling in 2021 to figure out how to invest in companies that were being priced at 100 times ARR in the seed. But now public companies in SaaS are trading at about 6 times ARR, and the private companies are doing rounds at 10 or 12 times ARR that are growing faster than the public companies. So those seem like more reasonable, sustainable valuations. But the problem you have in early stage venture today is all these companies that raised at 100, 150 times ARR, and the publics are at 6 now, their cap tables are upside down. That's why you see people like looking at the 1,500 unicorns that were out there and believing that, I've seen studies that think 60, 70% of them are not unicorns anymore because their unicorn valuations were based on multiples that are not related to the public market. At the end of the day, the public market is what you're going to be valued at some point in time. So private valuations need to come back around, and they have come back around to reasonable valuations. And I think that the ecosystem can work when at every level you have reasonable valuations. The ecosystem breaks down when you have mispriced opportunities.
So Martin, how long do you think it'll be until we see that first one-person unicorn company?
I don't think we will ever see a one-person unicorn company.
Why is that?
Companies are hard. And I don't care how much magic you have with AI and stuff like that. You still need customer service people, you still need developers, even if the developers are more productive. I have in the pre-seed, you have 4 basic jobs you have to do. You have to raise money, you have to build the product, you have to sell the product, and you have to operate the company. I have seen 2 or 3 people in my lifetime that could do all of those things. And that's like Elon Musk, Steve Jobs, and maybe Bill Gates. At the same time, they had huge teams around them. This is not solo people. And I have found that a company at the pre-seed, you need at least three people to do that, because it's at least three different jobs. The person who can raise money is many times not the person who can build the product. And as many times, it's different than the person that can sell the product, unless you're a technical company selling to other technical founders. Maybe sometimes that can be the same person, but then who operates the company, who handles HR and compliance and legal and all of that stuff, that's something that people who are very good at selling to customers hate doing. Paperwork, right? So you need at least four people. And I have never seen a one, I've seen a one owner company, but not a one person company.
And right now you're very active on Twitter.
Yeah.
Why are you so active on Twitter? Getting your words out there. What insights do you have for using this platform or that for other VCs?
I started getting more active on Twitter for exactly the reason we talked about before, which is I saw this low probability matching game problem. And I'm like, you know what? If I started telling people more the sectors that I like, the themes and this and that, maybe more founders who fit my profile would find me. And also maybe I could be helpful, right? Telling people things that are red flags in pitch decks or errors I've seen in cap table management or something like that. I just wanted to communicate more best practices to try to be helpful. And that's turned out to be very good. It's good for me to do that, but also it has created a deal flow. Like I say, I get about 300 companies a month, and probably 200 of them come through the forum on my Twitter profile. I did 6 new investments last year. 2 of them were cold inbound to that form from my Twitter feed. There were founders who followed me because I was providing helpful tips to founders. And when they decided to raise, they put their companies in my form and they discovered me on Twitter. I still did for 2/3 of the deals that came referred to me from previous founders or other VCs or things like that, which is the traditional sourcing method for VCs. But I am very open to cold introductions. And I know that there are plenty of people building things that are not in my network. VC has traditionally been a very closed network-based business, but I'm very excited about the opportunity with data and searching and forms and things like that for investors to discover great founders that are maybe outside their personal network. And I think that's a good thing for the founders and for the VCs.
And before wrapping up, any advice, suggestions on best practices that you'd like to share with our audience?
I would encourage founders to do more research on their VCs, to try to understand who they're pitching, what they've done. When you find the magical match between a founder that really gets you, it's really great. But you need to do more research on those things. And I would encourage founders to even call references. While VCs call references on founders, I think founders should call references on VCs. Call other CEOs that they have funded and say, has this guy been helpful? How has he been on your cap table? I think founders, rather than just walking around with their hand out, need to do a little more research to find what they hope could be the perfect investor for them. And the other side of the thing on the investor side, I think investors need to ramp up their game in terms of communicating their sweet spot to try to bridge this information asymmetry with founders. It will be more helpful. You will likely, like I have in the last year, get more founders who are aligned with what you're looking for if you tell people about them, like your family office. Let's all communicate a little bit more. That's the best practice that I have for both founders and investors.
Fantastic. Mart, would you like to share your Twitter handle or any way that founders out there, our audience, can get a hold of you and learn more about what you're working on?
Yeah, sure. So my Twitter handle is at Martin G. Tobias, and my website is www.incisive.vc, where you can read my musings about venture capital and see my portfolio. Love to talk to you.
Fantastic. And when I'm not hosting the Silicon Valley podcast, I'm an investment banker focused on mergers, acquisition, growth capital. Connect with me on LinkedIn and go to our website, the Silicon Valley Podcast, to find out more about future episodes and to see our archives. And with that, Martin, thank you for taking the time to be on this week's episode of the Silicon Valley Podcast.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you for listening to the Silicon Valley Podcast. To access our resources, visit us at thesiliconvalleypodcast.com and follow our host on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Sean Flynn SV. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional.